Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up. You get early payout on parlays, too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
It's Kelly Clarkson here to talk all things Wayfair, the best place to buy furniture, decor, and anything else you can think of to create a home you absolutely love. I know when I shop with Wayfair, I find options for every style, whether I'm feeling boho or farmhouse, modern, traditional, French country. I can find exactly what I need for my home and more. No matter your space, style, or budget, shop Wayfair.com to make your home way more you.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
Chapter 11 of The Eye of Osiris by R. Austin Freeman. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Chapter 11. The Evidence Reviewed.
"So the game has opened," observed Thorndyke, as he struck a match. "The play has begun with a cautious lead-off by the other side. Very cautious and not very confident."
"Why do you say not very confident?" I asked.
"Well, it is evident that Hurst, and I fancy Jellicoe too, is anxious to buy off Bellingham's opposition, and at a pretty long price under the circumstances. And when we consider how very little Bellingham has to offer against the presumption of his brother's death, it looks as if Hurst hasn't much to say on his side."
"No," said Jervis, "he can't hold many trumps or he wouldn't be willing to pay 400 a year for his opponent's chance, and that is just as well, for it seems to me that our own hand is a pretty poor one."
"We must look through our hand and see what we do hold," said Thorndyke. "Our trump card at present, a rather small one, I'm afraid, is the obvious intention of the testator that the bulk of the property should go to his brother."
"I suppose you will begin your inquiries now," I said.
"We began them some time ago, the day after you brought us the will, in fact. Jervis has been through the registers and has ascertained that no interment under the name of John Bellingham has taken place since the disappearance, which was just what we expected. He has also discovered that some other person has been making similar inquiries, which again is what we expected."
"And your own investigations?"
"Have given negative results for the most part. I found Dr. Norbury at the British Museum very friendly and helpful, so friendly, in fact, that I am thinking whether I may not be able to enlist his help in certain private researches of my own, with reference to the change effected by time in the physical properties of certain substances."
"Oh, you haven't told me about that," said Jervis.
"No, I haven't really commenced to plan my experiments yet, and they will probably need to nothing when I do. It occurred to me that possibly, in the course of time, certain molecular changes might take place in substances such as wood, bone, pottery, stucco, and other common materials, and that these changes might alter their power of conducting or transmitting molecular vibrations. Now, if this should turn out to be the case, it would be a fact of considerable importance, medical, legally, and otherwise, for it would be possible to determine approximately the age of any object of known composition by testing its reactions to electricity, heat, light, and other molecular vibrations. I thought of seeking Dr. Norbury's assistance because he can furnish me with materials for experiment of such great age that the reactions, if any, should be extremely easy to demonstrate. But to return to our case, I learned from him that John Bellingham had certain friends in Paris, collectors and museum officials, whom he was in the habit of visiting for the purpose of study and exchange of specimens. I had made inquiries of all these, and none of them had seen him during his last visit. In fact, I have not yet discovered anyone who had seen Bellingham in Paris on this occasion. So his visit there remains a mystery for the present.
It doesn't seem to be of much importance, since he undoubtedly came back, I remarked. But to this Thorndyke demurred.
"It is impossible to estimate the importance of the unknown," said he.
"Well, how does the matter stand," asked Jervis, "on the evidence that we have? John Bellingham disappeared on a certain date. Is there anything to show what was the manner of his disappearance?"
"The facts in our possession," said Thorndyke, "which are mainly those set forth in the newspaper report, suggests several alternative possibilities. And in view of the coming inquiry, for they will no doubt have to be gone into in court to some extent, it may be worthwhile to consider them. There are five conceivable hypotheses. Here Thorndyke checked them on his fingers as he proceeded. First, he may still be alive. Second, he may have died and been buried without identification. Third, he may have been murdered by some unknown person. Fourth, he may have been murdered by Hurst and his body concealed. Fifth, he may have been murdered by his brother. Let us examine these possibilities seriatim. First, he may still be alive. If he is, he must either have disappeared voluntarily, have lost his memory suddenly and not been identified, or have been imprisoned, on a false charge or otherwise. Let us take the first case, that of voluntary disappearance. Obviously, its improbability is extreme. Jellicoe doesn't think so, said I. He thinks it quite on the cards that John Bellingham is alive. He says that it is not a very unusual thing for a man to disappear for a time. Then why is he applying for a presumption of death? Just what I asked him. He says that it is the correct thing to do, that the entire responsibility rests on the court. That is all nonsense, said Thorndyke. Jellicoe is the trustee for his absent client, and if he thinks that client is alive, it is his duty to keep the estate intact, and he knows that perfectly well. We may take it that Jellicoe is of the same opinion as I am, that John Bellingham is dead. Still, I urged, men do disappear from time to time and turn up again after years of absence.
Yes, but for a definite reason. Either they are irresponsible vagabonds who take this way of shuffling off their responsibilities, or they are men who have been caught in a net of distasteful circumstances. For instance, a civil servant or a solicitor or a tradesman finds himself bound for life to a locality and an occupation of intolerable monotony.
Perhaps he has an ill-tempered wife, who, after the amiable fashion of a certain type of woman, thinking that her husband's pinned down without a chance of escape, gives a free rein to her temper. The man puts up with it for years, but at last it becomes unbearable. Then he suddenly disappears, and small blame to him. But this was not Bellingham's case. He was a wealthy bachelor with an engrossing interest in life, free to go whither he would and to do whatsoever he wished. Why should he disappear? The thing is incredible. As to his having lost his memory and remained unidentified, that also is incredible in the case of a man who had visiting cards and letters in his pocket, whose linen was marked, and who was being inquired for everywhere by the police. As to his being in prison, we may dismiss that possibility, inasmuch as a prisoner, both before and after conviction, would have full opportunity of communicating with his friends. The second possibility, that he may have died suddenly and been buried without identification, is highly improbable, but as it is conceivable that the body might have been robbed and the means of identification thus lost, it remains as a possibility that has to be considered, remote as it is. The third hypothesis, that he may have been murdered by some unknown person, is under the circumstances not wildly improbable. But as the police were on the lookout and a detailed description of the missing man's person was published in the papers, it would involve the complete concealment of the body. But this would exclude the most probable form of crime, the casual robbery with violence. It is therefore possible, but highly improbable. The fourth hypothesis is that Bellingham was murdered by Hurst. Now the one fact which mitigates against this view is that Hurst apparently had no motive for committing the murder. We are assured by Jellicoe that no one but himself knew the contents of the will, and if this is so, but mind, we have no evidence that it is so, Hurst would have no reason to suppose that he had anything material to gain by his cousin's death. Otherwise, the hypothesis presents no inherent improbabilities. The man was last seen alive at Hurst's house. He was seen to enter, and he was never seen to leave it. We are still taking the facts as stated in the newspapers, remember, and it now appears that he stands to benefit enormously by that man's death. But I objected, you are forgetting that directly the man was missed, Hurst and the servants together searched the entire house.
Yes, what did they search for?
Why, for Mr. Bellingham, of course.
Exactly, for Mr. Bellingham. That is, for a living man.
Now how do you search a house for a living man?
You look in all the rooms, When you look in a room, if he is there, you see him. If you do not see him, you assume that he is not there. You don't look under the sofa or behind the piano. You don't pull out large drawers or open cupboards. You just look into the rooms. That is what these people seem to have done. And they did not see Mr. Bellingham. Mr. Bellingham's corpse might have been stowed away out of sight in any one of the rooms that they looked into. That is a grim thought, said Jervis, but it is perfectly true. There is no evidence that the man was not lying dead in the house at the very time of the search. But even so, said I, there was the body to be disposed of somehow. Now, how could he possibly have got rid of the body without being observed? Ah, said Thorndyke, now we are touching on a point of crucial importance. If anyone should ever write a treatise on the art of murder, not an exhibition of literary fireworks like De Quincey's, but a genuine working treatise, he might leave all other technical details to take care of themselves, if he could describe some really practicable plan for disposing of the body. That is, and always has been, the great stumbling block to the murderer, to get rid of the body. The human body, he continued, thoughtfully regarding his pipe, just as in the days of my pupilage he was wont to regard the blackboard chalk, is a very remarkable object. It presents a combination of properties that make it singularly difficult to conceal permanently. It is bulky and of an awkward shape. It is heavy. It is completely incombustible. It is chemically unstable. And its decomposition yields great volumes of highly odorous gases. And it nevertheless contains identifiable structures of the highest degree of permanence. It is extremely difficult to preserve unchanged, and it is still more difficult completely to destroy. The essential permanence of the human body is well shown in the classical case of Eugene Aram, but a still more striking instance is that of Sekhenen Ra III, one of the last kings of the 17th Egyptian dynasty. Here, after a lapse of 4,000 years, it has been possible to determine not only the cause of death and the manner of its occurrence, but the way in which the king fell, the nature of the weapon with which the fatal wound was inflicted, and even the position of the assailant. And the permanence of the body under other conditions is admirably shown in the case of Dr. Parkman of Boston, USA, in which identification was actually effected by means of remains collected from the ashes of a furnace. Then we may take it, said Jervis, that the world has not yet seen the last of John Bellingham. I think we may regard that as almost a certainty, replied Thorndyke. The only question, and a very important one, is as to when the reappearance may take place. It may be tomorrow, or it may be centuries hence, when all the issues involved have been forgotten. Assuming, said I, for the sake of argument, that Hearst did murder him and that the body was concealed in the study at the time the search was made. How could it have been disposed of? If you had been in Hearst's place, how would you have gone to work? Thorndyke smiled at the bluntness of my question. You are asking me for an incriminating statement, said he, delivered in the presence of a witness, too. But as a matter of fact, there is no use in speculating a priori. We should have to reconstruct a purely imaginary situation, the circumstances of which are unknown to us, and we should almost certainly reconstruct it wrong. What we may fairly assume is that no reasonable person, no matter how immoral, would find himself in the position that you suggest. Murder is usually a crime of impulse, and the murderer a person of feeble self-control. Such persons are most unlikely to make elaborate and ingenious arrangements for the disposal of the bodies of their victims. Even the cold-blooded perpetrators of the most carefully planned murders appear, as I have said, to break down at this point. The almost insuperable difficulty of getting rid of the human body is not appreciated until the murderer suddenly finds himself face to face with it. In the case you are suggesting, the choice would seem to lie between burial on the premises or dismemberment and dispersal of the fragments, and either method would be pretty certain to lead to discovery. As illustrated by the remains of which you were speaking to Mr. Bellingham, Jervis remarked. Exactly, Thorndyke answered, though we could hardly imagine a reasonably intelligent criminal adopting a watercress bed as a hiding place. No, that was certainly an error of judgment. By the way, I thought it best to say nothing while you were talking to Bellingham, but I noticed that, in discussing the possibility of those being the bones of his brother, you made no comment on the absence of the third finger of the left hand. I am sure you didn't overlook it, but isn't it a point of some importance?
As to identification? Under the present circumstances, I think not. If there were a man missing who had lost that finger, it would, of course, be an important fact. But I have not heard of any such man. Or, again, if there were any evidence that the finger had been removed before death, it would be highly important. But there is no such evidence. It may have been cut off after death, and that is where the real significance of its absence lies.
I don't quite see what you mean, said Jervis.
I mean that if there is no report of any missing man who had lost that particular finger, the probability is that the finger was removed after death. And then arises the interesting question of motive. Why should it have been removed? It could hardly have become detached accidentally. What do you suggest?
Well, said Jervis, it might have been a peculiar finger. A finger, for instance, with some characteristic deformity, such as an ankylosed joint, which could have been easy to identify.
Yes, but that explanation introduces the same difficulty. No person with a deformed or ankylosed finger has been reported as missing.
Jervis puckered up his brows and looked at me. I'm hanged if I see any other explanation, he said. Do you, Berkeley?
I shook my head.
Don't forget which finger it is that is missing, said Thorndyke. The third finger of the left hand.
Oh, I see, said Jervis. The ring finger. You mean that it may have been removed for the sake of a ring that wouldn't come off?
Yes, it would not be the first instance of the kind. Fingers have been severed from dead hands, and even from living ones, for the sake of rings that were too tight to be drawn off. And the fact that it is the left hand supports the suggestion, for a ring that was inconveniently tight would be worn by preference on the left hand, as that is usually slightly smaller than the right.
What is the matter, Berkeley?
A sudden light had burst upon me, and I suppose my countenance betrayed the fact.
I am a confounded fool, I exclaimed.
Oh, don't say that, said Jervis. Give your friends a chance.
I ought to have seen this long ago and told you about it. John Bellingham did wear a ring, and it was so tight that when once he had got it on, he could never get it off again.
Did you happen to know on which hand he wore it? Thorndyke asked.
Yes, it was on the left hand, because Miss Bellingham, who told me about it, said that he would never have been able to get the ring on at all but for the fact that his left hand was slightly smaller than his right.
There it is, then, said Thorndyke. With this new fact in our possession, the absence of the finger furnishes the starting point of some very curious speculations.
As, for instance, said Jervis.
Ah, under the circumstances, I must leave you to pursue those speculations independently. I am now acting for Mr. Bellingham.
Jervis grinned and was silent for a while, refilling his pipe thoughtfully, but when he had got it alight, he resumed.
To return to the question of the disappearance, you don't consider it highly improbable that Bellingham might have been murdered by Hurst?
Oh, don't imagine I am making an accusation. I am considering the various probabilities merely in the abstract.
The same reasoning applies to the Bellinghams. As to whether any of them did commit the murder, that is a question of personal character. I certainly do not suspect the Bellinghams after having seen them, and with regard to Hurst, I know nothing, or at least very little, to his disadvantage.
Do you know anything? Asked Jervis.
Well, Thorndyke said with some hesitation, it seems a thought unkind to rake up the little details of a man's past, and yet it has to be done. I have, of course, made the usual routine inquiries concerning the parties to this affair, and this is what they have brought to light. Hurst, as you know, was a stockbroker, a man of good position and reputation, but about 10 years ago he seems to have committed an indiscretion, to put it mildly, which nearly got him into rather serious difficulties. He appears to have speculated rather heavily and considerably beyond his means, for when a sudden spasm of the markets upset his calculations, it turned out that he had been employing his client's capital in securities. For a time it looked as if there was going to be serious trouble. Then, quite unexpectedly, he managed to raise the necessary amount in some way and settle all claims. Whence he got the money has never been discovered to this day, which is a curious circumstance, seeing that the deficiency was rather over £5,000. But the important fact is that he did get it, and that he paid up all that he owed. So that he was only a potential defaulter, so to speak, and discreditable as the affair undoubtedly was,
It does not seem to have any direct bearing on this present case.
No, Jervis agreed, though it makes one consider his position with more attention than one would otherwise.
Undoubtedly, said Thorndyke, a reckless gambler is a man whose conduct cannot be relied on. He is subject to vicissitudes of fortune which may force him into other kinds of wrongdoing. Many an embezzlement has been preceded by an unlucky plunge on the turf.
Assuming the responsibility for this disappearance to lie between Hurst and the Bellingham, said I, with an uncomfortable gulp as I mentioned the names of my friends, to which side does the balance of probability incline?
To the side of Hurst, I should say, without doubt, replied Thorndyke. The case stands thus, on the facts presented to us. Hurst appears to have had no motive for killing the deceased, as we will call him, but the man was seen to enter the house and was never seen to leave it, and was never again seen alive. Bellingham, on the other hand, had a motive, as he had believed himself to be the principal beneficiary under the will. But the deceased was not seen at his house, and there is no evidence that he went to the house or to the neighborhood, excepting the scarab that was found there. But the evidence of the scarab is vitiated by the fact that Hurst was present when it was picked up, and that it was found on a spot over which Hurst had passed only a few minutes previously. Until Hurst is cleared, it seems to me that the presence of the scarab proves nothing against the Bellinghams.
Then your opinions on the case, said I, are based entirely on the facts that have been made public?
Yes, mainly. I do not necessarily accept those facts just as they are presented, and I may have certain views of my own on the case. But if I have, I do not feel in a position to discuss them. For the present, discussion has to be limited to the facts and inferences offered by the parties concerned.
There, exclaimed Jervis, rising to knock his pipe out, is where Thorndyke has you. He lets you think you're in the thick of the know until one fine morning you wake up and discover that you have only been a gaping outsider, and then you are mightily astonished, and so are the other side too, for that matter. But we must really be off now, mustn't we, Reverend Senior?
I suppose we must, replied Thorndyke, and as he drew on his gloves, he asked, Have you heard from Barnard lately?
Oh, yes, I answered. I wrote him at Smyrna to say that the practice was flourishing, and that I was quite happy and contented, and that he might stay away as long as he liked. He writes by return that he will prolong his holiday if an opportunity offers, but will let me know later.
Gad, said Jervis, it was a stroke of luck for Barnard that Bellingham happened to have such a magnificent daughter.
There, don't mind me, old man. You go in and win, she's worth it, isn't she, Thorndyke?
Miss Bellingham's a very charming young lady, replied Thorndyke. I am most favorably impressed by both the father and the daughter, and I only trust that we may be able to be of some service to them. With this sedate little speech, Thorndyke shook my hand, and I watched my two friends go on their way until their fading shapes were swallowed up in the darkness of Fetter Lane.
End of chapter 11.
Chapter 12 of The Eye of Osiris by R. Austin Freeman. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Chapter 12. A Voyage of Discovery. It was two or three mornings after my little supper party that, as I stood in the consulting room brushing my hat preparatory to starting on my morning round, Adolphus appeared at the door to announce two gentlemen waiting in the surgery. I told him to bring them in, and a moment later Thorndyke entered, accompanied by Jervis. I noted that they looked uncommonly large in that little apartment, especially Thorndyke, but I had no time to consider this phenomenon, for the latter, when he had shaken my hand, proceeded at once to explain the object of their visit. "We have come to ask a favor, Berkeley," he said, "to ask you to do us a very great service in the interest of your friends, the Bellinghams."
"You know I shall be delighted," I said warmly. "What is it?"
"I will explain. You know, or perhaps you don't, that the police have collected all the bones that have been discovered and deposited them in the mortuary at Woodford, where they are to be viewed by the coroner's jury. Now, it has become imperative that I should have more definite and reliable information than I can get from the newspapers. The natural thing for me would be to go down and examine them myself, but there are circumstances that make it very desirable that my connection with the case should not leak out. Consequently, I can't go myself, and for the same reason I can't send Jervis.
On the other hand, as it is now stated pretty openly that the police consider the bones to be almost certainly those of John Bellingham, it would seem perfectly natural that you, as Godfrey Bellingham's doctor, should go down to view them on his behalf.
I should like to, I said. I would give anything to go. But how is it to be managed?
It would mean a whole day off and leaving the practice to look after itself.
I think it could be managed, said Thorndyke, and the matter is really important for two reasons. One is that the inquest opens tomorrow, and someone certainly ought to be there to watch the proceedings on Godfrey's behalf. And the other is that our client has received notice from Hearst solicitors that the application will be heard in the probate court in a few days.
Isn't that rather sudden? I asked.
It certainly suggests that there has been a good deal more activity than we were given to understand. But you see the importance of the affair. The inquest will be a sort of dress rehearsal for the probate court, and it is quite essential that we should have a chance of estimating the management.
Yes, I see that, but how are we to manage about the practice?
We shall find you a substitute.
Through a medical agent?
Yes, said Jervis. Turcival will find us a man. In fact, he has done it.
I saw him this morning. He has a man who is waiting up in town to negotiate for the purchase of a practice and who would do the job for a couple of guineas. Quite a reliable man. Only say the word and I will run off to Adam Street and engage him definitely.
Very well. You engage the locum tenens and I will be prepared to start for Woodford as soon as he turns up.
Excellent, said Thorndyke. That is a great weight off my mind.
And if you could manage to drop in this evening and smoke a pipe with us, we could talk over the plan of campaign and let you know what items of information we are particularly in want of.
I promised to turn up at King's Bench Walk as soon after 8:30 as possible, and my two friends then took their departure, leaving me to set out in high spirits on my scanty round of visits. It is surprising what different aspects things present from different points of view, how relative are our estimates of the conditions and circumstances of life. To the urban workman, the journeyman baker or tailor, for instance, laboring year in, year out in a single building, a holiday ramble on Hampstead Heath is a veritable voyage of discovery. Whereas to the sailor, the shifting panorama of the whole wide world is but the commonplace of the day's work. So I reflected as I took my place in the train at Liverpool Street on the following day. There had been a time when a trip by rail to the borders of Epping Forest would have been far from a thrilling experience. Now, after vegetating in the little world of Fetter Lane, it was quite an adventure. The enforced inactivity of a railway journey is favorable to thought, and I had much to think about. The last few weeks had witnessed momentous changes in my outlook. New interests had arisen, new friendships had grown up. And above all, there had stolen into my life that supreme influence that, for good or evil, according to my fortune, was to color and pervade it even to its close. Those few days of companionable labor in the reading room, with the homely hospitalities of the milk shop and the pleasant walks homeward through the friendly London streets, had called into existence a new world, a world in which the gracious personality of Ruth Bellingham was the one dominating reality. And thus, as I leaned back in the corner of the railway carriage with an unlighted pipe in my hand, the events of the immediate past, together with those more problematical ones of the impending future, occupied me rather to the exclusion of the business of the moment, which was to review the remains collected in the Woodford mortuary until, as the train approached Stratford, the odors of the soap and bone manure factories poured in at the open window, and, by a natural association of ideas, brought me back to the object of my quest. As to the exact purpose of this expedition, I was not very clear, but I knew that I was acting as Thorndyke's proxy and thrilled with pride at the thought. But what particular light my investigations were to throw upon the intricate Bellingham case, I had no very definite idea. With a view to fixing the procedure in my mind, I took Thorndyke's written instructions from my pocket and read them over carefully. They were very full and explicit, making ample allowance for my lack of experience in medical legal matters. 1. Do not appear to make minute investigations or in any way excite remark. 2. Ascertain if all the bones belonging to each region are present, and if not, which are missing. 3. Measure the extreme length of the principal bones and compare those of opposite sides. 4. Examine the bones with reference to age, sex, and muscular development of the deceased. 5. Note the presence or absence of signs of constitutional disease, local disease of bone or adjacent structures, old or recent injuries, and any other departures from the normal or usual. 6. Observe the presence or absence of adipocere in its position, if present. 7. Note any remains of tendons, ligaments, or other soft structures. 8. Examine the Sid cup hand with reference to the question as to whether the finger was separated before or after death. 9. Estimate the probable period of submersion and note any changes, as example mineral or organic staining, due to the character of the water or mud. 10. Ascertain the circumstances, immediate and remote, that led to the discovery of the bones and the names of the persons concerned in those circumstances. 11. Commit all information to writing as soon as possible, and make plans and diagrams on the spot, if circumstances permit. 12. Preserve an impassive exterior. Listen attentively but without eagerness, ask as few questions as possible, pursue any inquiry that your observations on the spot may suggest. These were my instructions, and considering that I was going merely to inspect a few dry bones, they appeared rather formidable. In fact, the more I read them over, the greater became my misgivings as to my qualifications for the task. As I approached the mortuary, it became evident that some, at least, of Thorndyke's admonitions were by no means unnecessary. The place was in charge of a police sergeant, who watched my approach suspiciously, and some half-dozen men, obviously newspaper reporters, hovered about the entrance like a pack of jackals. I presented the coroner's order, which Mr. Marchmont had obtained, and which the sergeant read with his back against the wall, to prevent the newspaper men from looking over his shoulder. My credentials being found satisfactory, the door was unlocked and I entered, accompanied by three enterprising reporters, whom, however, the sergeant summarily ejected and locked out, returning to usher me into the presence and to observe my proceedings with intelligent but highly embarrassing interest. The bones were laid out on a large table and covered with a sheet, which the sergeant slowly turned back, watching my face intently as he did so, to note the impression that the spectacle made upon me. I imagine that he must have been somewhat disappointed by my impassive demeanor, for the remains suggested to me nothing more than a rather shabby set of students' osteology. The whole collection had been set out by the police surgeon, as the sergeant informed me, in their proper anatomical order, notwithstanding which I counted them over carefully to make sure that none were missing, checking them by the list with which Thorndyke had furnished me. "I see you have found the left thigh bone," I remarked, observing that this did not appear in the list. "Yes," said the sergeant, "that turned up yesterday evening in a big pond called Baldwin's Pond in the Sandpit Plain near Little Monk Wood." "Is that near here?" I asked. "In the forest up Loughton way," was the reply. I made a note of the fact, on which the sergeant looked as if he was sorry he had mentioned it, and then turned my attention to a general consideration of the bones before examining them in detail. Their appearance would have been improved and examination facilitated by a thorough scrubbing, for they were just as they had been taken from their respective resting places, and it was difficult to decide whether their reddish-yellow color was an actual stain or due to a deposit on the surface. In any case, as it affected them all alike, I thought it an interesting feature and made a note of it. They bore numerous traces of their sojourn in the various ponds from which they had been recovered, but these gave me little help in determining the length of time during which they had been submerged. They were, of course, encrusted with mud, and little wisps of pondweed stuck to them in places, but these facts furnished only the vaguest measure of time. Some of the traces were indeed more informing. To several of the bones, for instance, there adhered the dried egg clusters of the common pond snail, and in one of the hollows of the right shoulder blade, the infraspinous fossa, was a group of mud-built tubes of the red river worm. These remains gave proof of a considerable period of submersion, and since they could not have been deposited on the bones until all the flesh had disappeared, they furnished evidence that some time, a month or two at any rate, had elapsed since this had happened. Incidentally, too, their distribution showed the position in which the bones had lain, and though this appeared to be of no importance in the existing circumstances, I made careful notes of the situation of each adherent body, illustrating their position by rough sketches. The sergeant watched my proceedings with an indulgent smile. "You're making a regular inventory, sir," he remarked, as if he were going to put 'em up for auction. "I shouldn't think those snail's eggs would be much help in identification. And all that has been done already," he added as I produced my measuring tape. "No doubt," I replied, "but my business is to make independent observations, to check the others if necessary." And I proceeded to measure each of the principal bones separately and to compare those of the opposite sides. The agreement in dimensions and general characteristics of the pairs of bones left little doubt that all were parts of one skeleton, a conclusion that was confirmed by the eburnated patch on the head of the right thigh bone and the corresponding patch in the socket of the right hip bone. When I had finished my measurements, I went over the entire series of bones in detail, examining each with the closest attention for any of those signs which Thorndyke had indicated, and eliciting nothing but a monotonously reiterative negative. They were distressingly and disappointingly normal. "Well, sir, what do you make of 'em?" the sergeant asked cheerfully as I shut up my notebook and straightened my back. "Whose bones are they? Are they Mr. Bellingham's, think ye?" "I should be very sorry to say whose bones they are," I replied. "One bone is very much like another, you know." "I suppose it is," he agreed. "But I thought that with all that measuring and all those notes, you might have arrived at something definite." Evidently he was disappointed in me, and I was somewhat disappointed in myself when I contrasted Thorndyke's elaborate instructions with the meager result of my investigations. For what did my discoveries amount to? And how much was the inquiry advanced by the few entries in my notebook? The bones were apparently those of a man of fair though not remarkable muscular development, over 30 years of age, but how much older I was unable to say. His height I judged roughly to be 5 feet 8 inches, but my measurements would furnish data for a more exact estimate by Thorndyke. Beyond this, the bones were quite uncharacteristic. There were no signs of disease, either local or general, no indications of injuries either old or recent, no departures of any kind from the normal or usual, and the dismemberment had been effected with such care that there was not a single scratch on any of the separate surfaces. Of adipocere, the peculiar waxy or soapy substance that is commonly found in bodies that have been slowly decayed in damp situations, there was not a trace, and the only remnant of the soft structures was a faint indication, like a spot of dried glue, of the tendon on the tip of the right elbow. The sergeant was in the act of replacing the sheet with the air of a showman who was just given an exhibition when there came a sharp rapping on the mortuary door. The officer finished spreading the sheet with official precision, and having ushered me out into the lobby, turned the key and admitted 3 persons, holding the door open after they had entered for me to go out. But the appearance of the newcomers inclined me to linger. One of them was a local constable, evidently in official charge. A second was a laboring man, very wet and muddy, who carried a small sack, while in the third I thought I scented a professional brother. The sergeant continued to hold the door open. "Nothing more I can do for you, sir?" he asked genially. "Is that the divisional surgeon?" I inquired. "Yes, I am the divisional surgeon," the newcomer answered. "Did you want anything of me?" "This," said the sergeant, "is a medical gentleman who has got permission from the coroner to inspect the remains. He is acting for the family of the deceased, I mean for the family of Mr. Bellingham," he added in answer to an inquiring glance from the surgeon. "I see," said the latter. "Well, they have found the rest of the trunk, including, I understand, the ribs that were missing from the other part. Isn't that so, Davis?" "Yes, sir," replied the constable. "Inspector Badger says all the ribs is here, and all the bones of the neck as well." "The inspector seems to be an anatomist," I remarked. The sergeant grinned. "He is a very knowing gentleman, is Mr. Badger. He came down here this morning quite early and spent a long time looking over the bones and checking them by notes in his pocketbook. I fancy he's got something on, but he was precious close about it." Here the sergeant shut up rather suddenly, perhaps contrasting his own conduct with that of his superior. "Let us have these new bones out on the table," said the police surgeon. "Take the sheet off and don't shoot them out as if they were coals. Hand them out carefully." The laborer fished out the wet and muddy bones one by one from the sack, and as he laid them on the table, the surgeon arranged them in their proper relative positions. "This has been a neatly executed job," he remarked. "None of your clumsy hacking with a chopper or a saw. The bones have been cleanly separated at the joints. The fellow who did this must have some anatomical knowledge, unless he was a butcher, which, by the way, is not impossible. He has used his knife uncommonly skillfully, and you notice that each arm was taken off with the scapula attached, just as a butcher takes off a shoulder of mutton. Are there any more bones in that bag?" "No, sir," replied the laborer, wiping his hands with an air of finality on the posterior aspect of his trousers. "That's the lot." The surgeon looked thoughtfully at the bones as he gave a final touch to their arrangement and remarked, "The inspector is right. All the bones of the neck are there. Very odd, don't you think so?"
"You mean..." "I mean that this very eccentric murderer seems to have given himself such an extraordinary amount of trouble for no reason that one can see. There are these neck vertebrae, for instance. He must have carefully separated the skull from the atlas instead of just cutting through the neck. Then there is the way he divided the trunk. The 12th ribs have just come in with this lot, but the 12th dorsal vertebra to which they belong was attached to the lower half. Imagine the trouble he must have taken to do that, and without cutting or hacking the bones about either. It is extraordinary. This is rather interesting, by the way. Handle it carefully." He picked up the breastbone daintily, for it was covered with wet mud, and handed it to me with the remark, "That is the most definite piece of evidence we have." "You mean," I said, "that the union of the two parts into a single mass fixes this as a skeleton of an elderly man?" "Yes, that is the obvious suggestion, which is confirmed by the deposit of bone in the rib cartilages. You can tell the inspector, Davis, that I have checked this lot of bones and that they are all here." "Would you mind writing it down, sir?" said the constable. "Inspector Badger said I was to have everything in writing." The surgeon took out his pocketbook, and while he was selecting a suitable piece of paper, he asked, "Did you form any opinion as to the height of the deceased?" "Yes, I thought he would be about 5'8". Here I caught the sergeant's eyes fixed on me with a knowing leer. "I made it 5'8½", said the police surgeon. "But we shall know better when we have seen the lower leg bones. Where was this lot found, Davis?" "In the pond, just off the road in Lord's Bushes, sir. And the inspector has gone off now to..."
"Never mind where he has gone," interrupted the sergeant. "You just answer questions and attend to your business." The sergeant's reproof conveyed a hint to me on which I was not slow to act. Friendly as my professional colleague was, it was clear that the police were disposed to treat me as an interloper who was to be kept out of the know as far as possible. Accordingly, I thanked my colleague and the sergeant for their courtesy, and bidding them adieu until we should meet at the inquest, took my departure and walked away quickly until I found an inconspicuous position from which I could keep the door of the mortuary in view. A few moments later I saw Constable Davis emerge and stride away up the road. I watched his rapidly diminishing figure until he had gone as far as I considered desirable, and then I set forth in his wake. The road led straight away from the village, and in less than half a mile entered the outskirts of the forest. Here I quickened my pace to close up somewhat, and it was well that I did so, for suddenly he diverged from the road into a green lane, where for a while I lost sight of him. Still hurrying forward, I again caught sight of him just as he turned off into a narrow path that entered a beech wood with a thickish undergrowth of holly, along which I followed him for several minutes, gradually decreasing the distance between us, until suddenly there fell in my ear a rhythmical sound like the clank of a pump. Soon after I caught the sound of men's voices, and then the constable struck off the path into the wood. I now advanced more cautiously, endeavoring to locate the search party by the sound of the pump, and when I had done this I made a little detour so that I might approach from the opposite direction to that from which the constable had appeared. Still guided by the noise of the pump, I at length came out into a small opening among the trees and halted to survey the scene. The center of the opening was occupied by a small pond, not more than a dozen yards across, by the side of which stood a builder's handcart. The little two-wheeled vehicle had evidently been used to convey the appliances which were deposited on the ground near it,
and which consisted of a large tub, now filled with water, a shovel, a rake, a sieve, and a portable pump, the latter being fitted with a long delivery hose. There were three men besides the constable, one of whom was working the handle of the pump, while another was glancing at a paper that the constable had just delivered to him. He looked up sharply as I appeared and viewed me with unconcealed disfavor.
"Hello, sir," said he. "You can't come here."
Now, seeing that I was actually here, this was clearly a mistake, and I ventured to point out the fallacy.
"Well, I can't allow you to stay here. Our business is of a private nature."
"I know exactly what your business is, Inspector Badger."
"Oh, do you?" said he,
surveying me with a foxy smile. "And I expect I know what yours is, too. But we can't have any of you newspaper gentry spying on us just at present, so you just be off." I thought it best to undeceive him at once, and accordingly, having explained who I was, I showed him the coroner's permit, which he read with manifest annoyance. "This is all very well, sir," said he as he handed me back the paper, "but it doesn't authorize you to come spying on the proceedings of the police. Any remains that we discover will be deposited in the mortuary, where you can inspect them to your heart's content. But you can't stay here and watch us." I had no defined object in keeping a watch on the inspector's proceedings, but the sergeant's indiscreet hint had aroused my curiosity, which was further excited by Mr. Badger's evident desire to get rid of me. Moreover, while we had been talking, the pump had stopped, the muddy floor of the pond being now pretty fully exposed, and the inspector's assistant was handling the shovel impatiently. "Now I put it to you, Inspector," said I persuasively, "is it politic of you to allow it to be said that you refuse an authorized representative of the family facilities for verifying any statements that you may make hereafter?"
"What do you mean?" he asked.
"I mean that if you should happen to find some bone which could be identified as part of the body of Mr. Bellingham, that fact would be of more importance to his family than to anyone else. You know that there is a very valuable estate and a rather difficult will."
"I didn't know it, and I don't see the bearing of it now." "Neither did I, for that matter. But if you make such a point of being present at the search, I can't very well refuse. Only you mustn't get in our way, that's all."
On hearing this conclusion, his assistant, who looked like a plain-clothes officer, took up his shovel and stepped into the mud that formed the bottom of the pond, stooping as he went and peering among the masses of weed that had been left stranded by the withdrawal of the water. The inspector watched him anxiously, cautioning him from time to time to look out where he was treading. The laborer left the pump and craned forward from the margin of the mud, and the constable and I looked on from our respective points of vantage. For some time the search was fruitless. Once the searcher stooped and picked up what turned out to be a fragment of decayed wood. Then the remains of a long-deceased jay were discovered, examined, and rejected. Suddenly the man bent down by the side of a small pool that had been left in one of the deeper hollows, stared intently into the mud, and stood up.
"There's something here that looks like a bone, sir," he sang out.
"Don't grub about, then," said the inspector. "Drive your shovel right into the mud where you saw it and bring it to the sieve." The man followed out these instructions, and as he came shoreward with a great pile of the slimy mud on his shovel, we all converged on the sieve, which the inspector took up and held over the tub, directing the constable and laborer to lend a hand, meaning thereby that they were to crowd round the tub and exclude me as completely as possible. This, in fact, they did very effectively with his assistance, for when the shovelful of mud had been deposited on the sieve, the four men leaned over it and so nearly hid it from view that it was only by craning over, first on one side and then on the other, that I was able to catch an occasional glimpse of it and to observe it gradually melting away as the sieve, immersed in the water, was shaken to and fro. Presently the inspector raised the sieve from the water and stooped over it more closely to examine its contents. Apparently the examination yielded no very conclusive results, for it was accompanied by a series of rather dubious grunts. At length the officer stood up, and turning to me with a genial but foxy smile, held out the sieve for my inspection.
"Like to see what we have found, doctor?" said he.
I thanked him and stood over the sieve. It contained the sort of litter of twigs, skeleton leaves, weed, pond snails, dead shells, and freshwater mussels that one would expect to strain out from the mud of an ancient pond. but in addition to these there were three small bones which at first glance gave me quite a start until I saw what they were. The inspector looked at me inquiringly. "Hm?" said he. "Yes," I replied, "very interesting." "Those will be human bones, I fancy, hm?"
"I should say so, undoubtedly," I answered.
"Now," said the inspector, "could you say offhand which finger those bones belong to?" I smothered a grin, for I had been expecting the question, and answered, "I can say offhand that they don't belong to any finger. They are the bones of the left great toe." The inspector's jaw dropped.
"The deuce they are," he muttered.
"Hm, I thought they looked a bit stout." "I expect," said I, "that if you go through the mud close to where this came from, you'll find the rest of the foot." The plainclothes man proceeded at once to act on my suggestion, taking the sieve with him to save time. And sure enough, after filling it twice with the mud from the bottom of the pool, the entire skeleton of the foot was brought to light. "Now you're happy, I suppose," said the inspector, when I had checked the bones and found them all present. "I should be more happy," I replied, "if I knew what you were searching for in this pond. You weren't looking for the foot, were you?" "I was looking for anything that I might find," he answered. "I shall go on searching until we have the whole body. I shall go through all the streams and ponds around here excepting Connaught Water. That I shall leave to the last, as it will be a case of dredging from a boat and isn't so likely as the smaller ponds. Perhaps the head will be there. It's deeper than any of the others." It now occurred to me that as I had learned all that I was likely to learn, which was little enough, I might as well leave the inspector to pursue his researches unembarrassed by my presence. Accordingly, I thanked him for his assistance and departed by the way I had come. But as I retraced my steps along the shady path, I speculated profoundly on the officer's proceedings. My examinations of the mutilated hand had yielded the conclusion that the finger had been removed after death or shortly before, but more probably after. Someone else had evidently arrived at the same conclusion, and had communicated his opinion to Inspector Badger, for it was clear that that gentleman was in full cry after the missing finger. But why was he searching for it here when the hand had been found at Sidcup? And what did he expect to learn from it when he found it? There was nothing particularly characteristic about a finger, or at least the bones of one, and the object of the present researches was to determine the identity of the person of whom these bones were the remains. There was something mysterious about the affair, something suggesting that Inspector Badger was in possession of private information of some kind. But what information could he have? And whence could he have obtained it? These were questions to which I could find no answer, and I was still fruitlessly revolving them when I arrived at the modest inn where the inquest was to be held, and where I proposed to fortify myself with a correspondingly modest lunch as a preparation for my attendance at the inquiry. End of chapter 12.
Chapter 13 of The Eye of Osiris by R. Austin Freeman. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Chapter 13. The Coroner's Quest. The proceedings of that fine old institution, the coroner's court, are apt to have their dignity impaired by the somewhat unjudicial surroundings amidst which they are conducted. The present inquiry was to be held in a long room attached to the inn, ordinarily devoted, as its various appurtenances testified, to gatherings of a more convivial character. Hither I betook myself after a protracted lunch and a meditative pipe, and being the first to arrive, the jury having already been sworn and conducted to the mortuary to view the remains, whiled away the time by considering the habits of the customary occupants of the room by the light of the objects contained in it. A wooden target with one or two darts sticking in it hung on the end wall and invited the Robin Hoods of the village to try their skill. A system of incised marks on the oaken table made sinister suggestions of shove halfpenny, and a large open box filled with white wigs, gaudily colored robes and wooden spears, swords and regalia, crudely coated with gilded paper, obviously appertained to the puerile ceremonials of the Order of Druids. I had exhausted the interest of these relics and had transferred my attentions to the picture gallery when the other spectators and the witnesses began to arrive.
Hastily, I seated myself in the only comfortable chair beside the one placed at the head of the table, presumably for the coroner, and I had hardly done so when the latter entered accompanied by the jury. Immediately after them came the sergeant, Inspector Badger, one or two plainclothesmen, and finally the divisional surgeon. The coroner took his seat at the head of the table and opened his book, and the jury seated themselves on a couple of benches on one side of the long table. I looked with some interest at the 12 good men and true. They were a representative group of British tradesmen, quiet, attentive, and rather solemn. But my attention was particularly attracted by a small man with a very large head and a shock of upstanding hair, whom I had diagnosed, after a glance at his intelligent but truculent countenance and the shiny knees of his trousers, as the village cobbler. He sat between the broad-shouldered foreman who looked like a blacksmith and a dogged red-faced man whose general aspect of prosperous greasiness suggested the calling of a butcher. "The inquiry, gentlemen," the coroner commenced, "upon which we are now entering, concerns itself with two questions. The first is that of identity. Who was this person whose body we have just viewed? The second is, how, when, and by what means did he come by his death? We will take the identity first to begin with the circumstances under which the body was discovered." Here the cobbler stood up and raised an excessively dirty hand. "I rise, Mr. Chairman," said he, "to a point of order." The other jurymen looked at him curiously, and some of them, I regret to say, grinned. "You have referred, sir," he continued, "to the body which we have just viewed. I wish to point out that we have not viewed a body. We have viewed a collection of bones." "We will refer to them as the remains, if you prefer it," said the coroner. "I do prefer it," was the reply, and the objector sat down. "Very well," rejoined the coroner, and he proceeded to call the witnesses, of whom the first was a laborer who had discovered the bones in the watercress bed. "Do you happen to know how long it was since the watercress beds had been cleaned out previously?" the coroner asked, when the witness had told the story of the discovery. "They was cleaned out by Mr. Tapper's orders just before he gave them up. That will be a little better than 2 years ago. In May it were. I helped to clean 'em. I worked on this very same place, and there wasn't no bones there then." The coroner glanced at the jury. "Any questions, gentlemen?" he asked. The cobbler directed an intimidating scowl at the witness and demanded, "Were you searching for bones when you came on these remains?" "Me," exclaimed the witness. "What should I be searching for bones for?" "Don't prevaricate," said the cobbler sternly. "Answer the question, yes or no." "No, of course I wasn't." The juryman shook his enormous head dubiously, as though implying that he would let it pass this time, but it mustn't happen again. And the examination of the witnesses continued, without eliciting anything that was new to me or giving rise to any incident, until the sergeant had described the finding of the right arm in the cuckoo pits. "Was this an accidental discovery?" the coroner asked. "No. We had instructions from Scotland Yard to search any likely ponds in this neighborhood." The coroner discreetly forbore to press this matter any further, but my friend the cobbler was evidently on the qui vive, and I anticipated a brisk cross-examination for Mr. Badger when his turn came. The inspector was apparently of the same opinion, for I saw him cast a glance of the deepest malevolence at the too inquiring disciple of St. Crispin. In fact, his turn came next, and the cobbler's hair stood up with unholy joy. The finding of the lower half of the trunk in Staples Pond at Loughton was the inspector's own achievement, but he was not boastful about it. The discovery, he remarked, followed naturally on the previous one in the cuckoo pits. "Had you any private information that led you to search this particular neighborhood?" the cobbler asked. "We had no private information whatever," replied Badger. "Now I put it to you," pursued the juryman, shaking a forensic and very dirty forefinger at the inspector. "Here are certain remains found at Sidcup. Here are certain other remains found at St. Mary Cray, and certain others at Lee. All those places are in Kent. Now, isn't it very remarkable that you should come straight down to Epping Forest, which is in Essex, and search for those bones and find 'em?" "We were making a systematic search of all likely places," replied Badger. "Exactly," said the cobbler, with a ferocious grin. "That's just my point. I say, isn't it very funny that after finding the remains in Kent some 20 miles from here, with the River Thames between, you should come here to look for the bones and go straight to Staples Pond, where they happen to be, and find them?
It would have been more funny, Badger replied sourly, if we'd gone straight to a place where they happened not to be and found them.
A gratified snigger arose from the other 11 good men and true, and the cobbler grinned savagely, but before he could think of a suitable rejoinder, the coroner interposed. The question is not very material, he said, and we mustn't embarrass the police by unnecessary inquiries.
It's my belief, said the cobbler, that he knew they were there all the time.
The witness has stated that he had no private information, said the coroner, and he proceeded to take the rest of the inspector's evidence, watched closely by the critical juror. The account of the finding of the remains having been given in full, the police surgeon was called and sworn. The jurymen straightened their backs with an air of expectancy, and I turned over a page of my notebook. You have examined the bones at present lying in the mortuary and forming the subject of this inquiry? The coroner asked.
I have.
Will you kindly tell us what you have observed?
I find that the bones are human bones, and are, in my opinion, all parts of the same person. They form a skeleton which is complete with the exception of the skull, the third finger of the left hand, the kneecaps, and the leg bones. I mean the bones between the knees and the ankles.
Is there anything to account for the absence of the missing finger?
No, there is no deformity and no sign of its having been amputated during life. In my opinion, it was removed after death.
Can you give us any description of the deceased?
I should say that these are the bones of an elderly man, probably over 60 years of age, about 5 feet 8.5 inches in height, a rather stout build, fairly muscular and well preserved. There are no signs of disease excepting some old-standing rheumatic gout of the right hip joint.
Can you form any opinion as to the cause of death?
No, there are no marks of violence or signs of injury, but it will be impossible to form any opinion as to the cause of death until we have seen the skull.
Did you note anything else of importance?
Yes, I was struck by the appearance of anatomical knowledge and skill on the part of the person who dismembered the body. The knowledge of anatomy is proved by the fact that the corpse has been divided into definite anatomical regions. For instance, the bones of the neck are complete and include the top joint of the backbone known as the atlas, whereas a person without anatomical knowledge would probably take off the head by cutting through the neck. Then the arms have been separated with the scapula, or shoulder blade, and clavicle, or collarbone, attached, just as an arm would be removed for dissection. The skill is shown by the neat way in which the dismemberment has been carried out. The parts have not been rudely hacked asunder, but have been separated at the joints so skillfully that I have not discovered a single scratch or mark of the knife on any of the bones.
Can you suggest any class of person who would be likely to possess the knowledge and skill to which you refer?
It would, of course, be possessed by a surgeon or medical student, and possibly by a butcher.
You think that the person who dismembered this body may have been a surgeon or a medical student?
Yes, or a butcher. Someone accustomed to the dismemberment of bodies and skillful with the knife.
Here the cobbler suddenly rose to his feet.
I rise, Mr. Chairman, said he, to protest against the statement that has just been made.
What statement? Demanded the coroner.
Against the aspersion, continued the cobbler, with an oratorical flourish, that has been cast upon an honorable calling.
I don't understand you, said the coroner.
Dr. Summers has insinuated that this murder was committed by a butcher. Now a member of that honorable calling is sitting on this jury.
You let me alone, growled the butcher.
I will not let you alone, persisted the cobbler. I desire—
Oh, shut up, Pope.
This was from the foreman, who at the same moment reached out an enormous hairy hand with which he grabbed the cobbler's coattails and brought him into a sitting posture with a thump that shook the room.
But Mr. Pope, though seated, was not silenced. I desire, he said, to have my protest put on record.
I can't do that, said the coroner, and I can't allow you to interrupt the witnesses.
I am acting, said Mr. Pope, in the interests of my friend here and the members of a honorable—
But here the butcher turned on him savagely and in a hoarse stage whisper exclaimed, "Look here, Pope, you've got too much of what the cat licks." "Gentlemen, gentlemen," the coroner protested sternly, "I cannot permit this unseemly conduct. You are forgetting the solemnity of the occasion in your own responsible positions. I must insist on more decent and decorous behavior." There was profound silence, in the midst of which the butcher concluded in the same hoarse whisper, "Licks her paws with." The coroner cast a withering glance at him, and turning to the witness, resumed the examination. "Can you tell us, doctor, how long a time has elapsed since the death of the deceased?" "I should say not less than 18 months, but probably more." "How much more is impossible from inspection alone to say. The bones are perfectly clean, that is, clean of all soft structures, and will remain substantially in their present condition for many years." "The evidence of the man who found the remains in the watercress bed suggests that they could not have been there for more than 2 years. Do the appearances, in your opinion, agree with that view?"
"Yes, perfectly."
"There is one more point, doctor, a very important one. Do you find anything in any of the bones, or all of them together, which would enable you to identify them as the bones of any particular individual?"
"No," replied Dr. Summers, "I found no peculiarity that could furnish the means of personal identification."
"The description of a missing individual has been given to us," said the coroner. "A man 59 years of age, 5 feet 8 inches in height, healthy, well-preserved, rather broad in build, and having an old Potts fracture of the left ankle." "Do the remains that you have examined agree with that description?"
"Yes, so far as agreement is possible. There is no disagreement."
"The remains might be those of that individual?"
"They might, but there is no positive evidence that they are.
The description would apply to a large proportion of elderly men, except as to the fracture."
"You found no signs of such a fracture?"
"No, Potts' fracture affects the bone called the fibula. That is one of the bones that has not yet been found, so there is no evidence on that point. The left foot was quite normal, but then it would be in any case, unless the fracture had resulted in great deformity."
"You estimated the height of the deceased as 1/2 inch greater than that of the missing person. Does that constitute a disagreement?"
"No, my estimate is only approximate. As the arms are complete and the legs are not, I have based my calculations on the width across the two arms. But measurement of the thigh bones gives the same result. The length of the thigh bones is 1 foot 7 inches and 5/8".
"So the deceased might not have been taller than 5 foot 8?
"That is so, from 5 feet 8 to 5 feet 9.
"Thank you. I think that is all we want to ask you, doctor, unless the jury wish to put any questions."
He glanced uneasily at the august body, and instantly the irrepressible Pope rose to the occasion. "About that finger that is missing," said the cobbler, "you say that it was cut off after death?"
"That is my opinion."
"Now, can you tell us why it was cut off?"
"No, I cannot."
"Oh, come now, Dr. Summers, you must have formed some opinion on the subject."
Here the coroner interposed. "The doctor is only concerned with the evidence arising out of the actual examination of the remains. Any personal opinions or conjectures that he may have formed are not evidence, and he must not be asked about them."
"But, sir," objected Pope, "we want to know why that finger was cut off. It couldn't have been took off for no reason. May I ask, sir, if the person who was missing had anything peculiar about that finger?"
"Nothing is stated to that effect in the written description," replied the coroner.
"Perhaps," suggested Pope, "Inspector Badger can tell us."
"I think," said the coroner, "we had better not ask the police too many questions. They will tell us anything that they wish to be made public."
"Oh, very well," snapped the cobbler. "If it's a matter of hushing it up, I've no more to say. Only I don't see how we are to arrive at a verdict if we don't have the facts put before us."
All the witnesses having now been examined, the coroner proceeded to sum up and address the jury. "You have heard the evidence, gentlemen, of the various witnesses, and you will have perceived that it does not enable us to answer either of the questions that form the subject of this inquiry. We now know that the deceased was an elderly man, about 60 years of age, and about 5 feet 8 to 9 in height,
and that his death took place from 18 months to 2 years ago. That is all we know. From the treatment to which the body has been subjected, we may form conjectures as to the circumstances of his death. But we have no actual knowledge. We do not know who the deceased was or how he came by his death. Consequently, it will be necessary to adjourn this inquiry until fresh facts are available, and as soon as that is the case, you will receive due notice that your attendance is required. The silence of the court gave place to the confused noise of moving chairs and a general outbreak of eager talk, amidst which I rose and made my way out into the street. At the door I encountered Dr. Summers, whose dog cart was waiting close by. "Are you going back to town now?" he asked. "Yes," I answered, "as soon as I can catch a train." "If you jump into my cart, I'll run you down in time for the 5:1. You'll miss it if you walk." I accepted his offer thankfully, and a minute later was spinning briskly down the road to the station. "Queer little devil, that man Pope," Dr. Summers remarked. "Quite a character. A socialist, laborite, agitator, general crank. Anything for a row." "Yes," I answered, "that was what his appearance suggested. It must be trying for the coroner to get a truculent rascal like that on a jury." Summers laughed. "I don't know. He supplies the comic relief. And then, you know, those fellows have their uses. Some of his questions were pretty pertinent." "So Badger seemed to think." "Yes, by Jove," chuckled Summers. Badger didn't like him a bit, and I suspect the worthy inspector was sailing pretty close to the wind at his answers. "You think he really has some private information?" "Depends upon what you mean by information. The police are not a speculative body. They wouldn't be taking all this trouble unless they had a pretty straight tip from somebody." "How are Mr. and Miss Bellingham? I used to know them when they lived here." I was considering a discreet answer to this question when we swept into the station yard. At the same moment the train drew up at the platform, and with a hurried handshake and hastily spoken thanks, I sprang from the dog cart and darted into the station. During the rather slow journey homeward, I read over my notes and endeavored to extract from the facts they set forth some significance other than that which lay on the surface, but without much success. Then I fell to speculating on what Thorndyke would think of the evidence at the inquest and whether he would be satisfied with the information that I had collected. These speculations lasted me, with occasional digressions, until I arrived at the Temple and ran up the stairs rather eagerly to my friend's chambers. But here a disappointment awaited me. The nest was empty with the exception of Polton, who appeared at the laboratory door in his white apron with a pair of flat-nosed pliers in his hands. The doctor had to go down to Bristol to consult over an urgent case, he explained, and Dr. Jervis has gone with him. They'll be away a day or two, I expect, but the doctor left this note for you. He took a letter from the shelf where it had been stood conspicuously on edge and handed it to me. It was a short note from Thorndyke apologizing for his sudden departure and asking me to give Polton my notes with any comments that I had to make. "You will be interested to learn," he added, "that the application will be heard in the probate court the day after tomorrow. I shall not be present, of course, nor will Jervis, so I should like you to attend and keep your eyes open for anything that may happen during the hearing and that may not appear in the notes that Marchmont's clerk will be instructed to take. I have retained Dr. Payne to stand by and help you with the practice, so that you can attend the court with a clear conscience." This was highly flattering and quite a tone for the small disappointment. With deep gratification at the trust that Thorndyke had reposed in me, I pocketed the letter, handed my notes to Polton, wished him good evening, and betook myself to Fetter Lane. End of chapter 13.
Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up. You get early payout on parlays, too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.